Ahoy! You're listening to Diffuse Tab with Kenny Estes and Isla Krem. Today, we are chatting with Ian Hedrick, the founder of City Farms. We'll be discussing why the agricultural department is investing $3 billion into the food sector, whether a nonprofit structure is well suited for farming innovation investments, and discuss the ethicality of de-risking farming and sustainability. Enjoy. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Hope you enjoyed meeting, talking, discoursing in the room. We are, if this is your first time here, you might be confused. So here's what's on tap. This is a weekly event. We've done it 202 weeks in a row, which is bananas. We are going to briefly talk about Diffuse Tap, the event you're in right now, and Diffuse Funds. We're going to follow that up with a 15-minute Q&A with Mr. Ian Hedrick, followed by two more rounds of tap rooms, because this is mostly networking. 45 minutes of every hour we spend in small groups of four, five, six, whatever, to meet each other, kind of like speed dating, but more businessy. Pretty much all of the audience play in the alternative investment space in one way, shape, or form. We also skew pretty heavily towards crypto assets. That is not a hard and fast requirement, as we'll see with today, but generally speaking, we're dealing with crypto assets. We do want you to learn a little bit, which is why we have folks like Mr. Ian Hedrick on to share some of his wisdom. Diffuse Funds is the company putting this show on the road. But what we do is we launch funds, notably Diffuse Digital 30, which is a top 30 market cap weighted index fund. It's a fancy way of saying it's trying to invest like the S&P 500, but for crypto assets, and that is publicly traded. So we are in aggressive scale-up mode right now. So we're looking for distribution partners to kind of help drive our growth. If you or anyone you know is interested in having that conversation, do not be shy to send them our way. But enough about us. We're here to hear from Mr. Hedrick. So Ian, I did see you in the room. Do you want to unmute yourself? Thank you for joining us. Unmute yourself. Tell the good folks Hello. A little bit about your background and what you're up to at City Farm.
My name's Ian Hedrick. I'm founder of City Farmers. Background is very blue collar. You know, I had a dad who was a carpenter, a mom who was a self-employed seamstress, realized from a young age that you could become an entrepreneur. You know, you didn't have to go get a job and work for somebody. That was not my dad's desire. He really wanted me to go get a government job like him and get a pension, but it just wasn't for me. So after a 3-year gap from high school, I moved to Chicago for architecture school. Originally, the plan was bachelor's of architecture, master's of civil engineering. For better or worse, had to drop out after a couple of years, but realized having moved to Chicago that there was a really flourishing urban agriculture scene here. It's the most urban ag friendly city in America. The zoning is very friendly for it, makes it very simple to do here. And there's actually 890 documented either farms or community gardens within the city. So really a massive thing. Worked in the industry for a few years for other people, knowing that, you know, something was possible, but let me go validate my assumptions, you know, let me go test this theory and see what's going on. And after a few years, realized like, wow, there's a ton of potential here. But for better or worse, maybe a lot of the companies doing it, maybe things could be brought to another level, you know. So spent about a year forming a partnership with the Public Health Institute of Metropolitan Chicago. That's who City Farmers operates through via fiscal sponsorship. And then, after a year, we launched finally at the top of this year, and now we're up and running. So
amazing. I have a confession to make. Yeah. I know almost nothing about this space. So can you kind of set the stage a little bit? Like, I gather the U.S. government's pretty active in trying to promote this type of stuff. Like, what is the status quo at the moment?
Yeah, so VC is taking some stabs at vertical and urban farming in the past. One of our advisors actually raised $1 billion in 2012. He built out a 90,000 square foot warehouse over by O'Hare Airport, had 5 levels of hydroponics in there. They were selling to Whole Foods, Mariano's, all the major grocers in the city. Very similar to Aero Farms. If any of you have heard of Aero Farms out of New York that recently went bankrupt, basically the investors of Farmed Here saw what was coming. with Arrow Farms and just shut down the farm back in 2017. After those failed experiments, VC kind of had a bad taste in their mouth and left the industry to the wayside. But the food system still is very fragile across the board. If you really take a look at the way we ship food, you know, across borders from multiple nations to get here, it's on average in Chicago, our food travels 1,500 miles before it gets here. So thanks to the pandemic and all the supply shortages and kind of the exposure of how fragile some of our global supply chains are, it's called the Food System Transformation Framework, specifically for urban agriculture research. And fortunately, a lot of corporations also, like the American Heart Association, GitLabs, and others, are also pouring money into this. So where the for-profit sector hasn't been willing to move for good reason, you know, based on bad experiences, the nonprofit sector stepped up to carry the weight, which makes sense because one of the purposes of nonprofits isn't just alleviation of the poor, right? It's also the advancement of science.
Okay, so kind of the story I'm hearing, and your mic is kind of cutting in and out, at least for me. Maybe everybody else has perfect audio, but just as an FYI, there's nothing you can do about that. So VC came in, they did for-profit investments. Generally, those flopped a little bit. And now the stage is being set by pretty significant subsidies by the U.S. government, as well as these kind of like 501c3 organizations. Are you structured as such, a 501c3 kind of a... And how does that... I don't know, I'm got a VC background. Like, how does that work? Like, when you're talking to investors and you're pitching what you're doing and you're saying you're a nonprofit, like, how does that conversation go?
Yeah, 100%. So we're structured, we operate through a fiscal sponsorship. We have a 501c3, the Public Health Institute of Metropolitan Chicago. They're a 30-year-old public health nonprofit that was spun out from the city's government, actually, about 12 years ago. They're the 501c3 of record, right? Our money hits their bank account, and then from there, we get used it for our purposes. It's an annual contract. Apologies for the audio issues. I just moved into a new apartment. I'm connected to my phone's hotspot because the internet hasn't gotten set up yet. I thought it was going to be a little more stable, so I'm going to do my best here. So yeah, we operate through a fiscal sponsorship with a public health institute. And the way the conversations, you know, with investors go is, look, for a lot of these grants, you know, from the government, et cetera, we can get multi-million dollar grants, right? Especially with the prestige of the fiscal sponsor we operate through. But we do need matching capital going into it, right? Oftentimes you need 25 to 50% of the capital already, and then they can support the rest. But the beauty of it is not only do you get the prestige of working with this type of nonprofit, you also get to get in early on the technological advancements we're making. What we can offer to investors isn't an immediate return, right? I can't promise, you know, a return on an investment currently. What we can promise is first right of refusal on any intellectual property that we develop, right? So rather than I think of us as the OpenAI of urban and vertical agriculture, but rather than using some crazy distorted corporate structure of like three different corporations all tied up in weird ways, it's very simple. Our nonprofit generates intellectual property. That intellectual property is licensed to a for-profit, and that for-profit can accept capital to scale it. Gotcha. So we offer first right of refusal.
Gotcha. So in this case, the nonprofit here, is there a tie to academia as well? Or when you're talking about the intellectual property, this is just something you're developing in-house, or are you actually going and partnering with universities, pulling it? Because that's something we've heard before, where you kind of like use nonprofits to do deep research in kind of like an academic setting. And then when you want to monetize that IP down the road, then it becomes a for-profit. Is that kind of the play here?
That is kind of the play here. So it's a little bit of both. There's a fair bit that we can do independently, right? We have a Canadian researcher on our team who's been very deep in controlled environment sciences since like the 80s. He's worked with DuPont and a bunch of really big corporations developing some really fantastic greenhouse technology. And then we also have a technology partner based out of Lithuania for the growing methodology. So our system, it's true vertical. It's these towers. We spray a fog on the roots of plants to make it very simple. The academic partners do come in there. We're having a number of conversations to form those partnerships, and it definitely is part of the hope. The beauty, we have technology that's about this close to being market ready that we don't need the academic partners to prove out. But there are other technologies and other crops that are going to take a little bit longer, that those are the conversations we're having with the academic partners about.
Gotcha. Yeah. So are you sick and tired of strawberries yet?
I'm not. I love strawberries so much. And that's the thing about it. So we're really just emulating the way the biggest berry company in the world got to be the biggest berry company in the world. In the 1940s, Driscoll's bought a berry research program from the state of California. Hmm. Spent about a decade researching roughly the breed of berry that's on the shelves today, the Z57 berry. And then once they recognized that they had a berry that could ship from California to New York and not spoil, right, and sit on the shelf for a few days and still look pretty, they deployed it into the market. So it's very similar to what they're doing. Unfortunately, the way that they industrialize berries means it's a 40% cost of goods sold product, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of margin there to be eaten up. The napkin math shows the technology that we're about to deploy could cut that in half.
Okay. And the reason for that is the transportation costs. So you do local growing, potentially you can make it less durable. Maybe that has an impact on the actual taste of these fruits and vegetables down the road. Is that kind of the idea? And then you're saving effectively gas on moving this crap around, the food around.
It's also significantly more land efficient. We can grow in an eighth of an acre, an acre's worth of strawberries, right? So Driscoll's is using more traditional agricultural techniques. So we're significantly more land efficient. We use 90 to 95% less water. And then yes, ultimately it is a more flavorful and nutritious product as well.
Interesting. And you're running these farms yourself, or are you like working with local, like, I don't know, condo associations, or like, how does that work for this? Cause I mean, these aren't huge farms, right? I'm assuming they're relatively small and just kind of like spread all over the various rooftops in the urban areas.
Not rooftops. So most rooftops are just, the engineering of buildings is not designed to handle rooftop gardens. So looking at vacant land in cities, right? So your average lot in Chicago is 25 feet by 125 feet. And on any of those lots, we can grow a minimum of 5,000 plants at a time.
Gotcha. Okay. So you are actually doing the farming, and I'm assuming they tore down a bunch of houses like on the south side of Chicago, maybe, you know, a decade or so ago. And like a lot of those are still vacant. So that's kind of where you're primarily focusing at the moment.
Yep. The city of Chicago owns give or take 30,000 vacant lots. Mm. The napkin math, if we were to grow romaine lettuce and sell it for $2 a head, which is undercutting Whole Foods prices, and we put one of our greenhouses on every vacant lot that the city of Chicago owns, we'd have a $2.25 billion annual revenue business.
Wow.
Yep.
Interesting. And a much lower cost of goods sold, which bumps your margin. Interesting.
Yes.
That's truly fascinating. But you are starting in strawberries, right? Is that romaine lettuce? Like, I don't even know, like, what's the trajectory? You mentioned berries, but like, what are the hard kind of vegetables? Just morbid curiosity.
Yeah, blueberries are super difficult. We'd like to take those on. You know, that's a lot of the conversation we're having academic partners is blueberries, because they're just a difficult crop to grow. But strawberries, there's been a decent bit of research. So Singapore and Japan, they really are where like the foundational research and white papers for what we're doing came out of. So we're big focused on strawberries, in part because like every lettuce, kale, spinach, like it's been done. You know, there's no reason for us to try to compete with Gotham Greens. They have 100,000 square foot greenhouse on the south side, growing plenty of lettuce and basil for the whole city. It's another market, and it's a very, again, high margin product. So there's ample room for disruption to happen there.
Gotcha. I'm going to pick up a couple questions from the chat. One from Mr. Len Bland. Does qualify as organic? I mean, I don't even know what organic means, honestly, but
what does organic even mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're pursuing organic certification from the USDA. There are certain qualifications to meet there, but it's organic kind of means everything and nothing. As long as you meet their qualifications, you can get the stamp.
Gotcha. Okay. Aaron had an interesting idea. You talked about vacant lots, but you are putting a greenhouse down. Walmart apparently shut down a lot of stores on the south side not long ago. Like, is this something that you could stick into empty, I don't know, shopping malls or big boxes?
The tricky thing, and again, this is what our advisor found when he raised the $25 million in 2012. So they had a 90,000 square foot, it was like a cardboard factory, basically, right? So very similar to like a Walmart building. When you don't have sunlight, it becomes very expensive because you need to import your lights, you know, your energy. And that just racks up the cost like extensively. So maybe, you know, but it's really not the best idea, you know, building greenhouses and using controlled environments where the sunlight is powering your plants to the fullest extent possible is it's a big part of the equation.
Gotcha. Meredith had a question with two hearts on it. So this is going to be a good one. Do you want to grow weed?
Do we want to grow weed? Yeah, you know, it's the market's like kind of tricky. I've had some conversations with some people about it. I mean, we're open to it. You know, it's a revenue stream for sure. I mean, but I'm not that excited by cannabis, to be honest. The food system's very fragile. You know, I know it's very easy to think, especially here in Chicago, you know, I live walking distance to a Whole Foods and a Trader Joe's. It's very easy to think that food is abundant and it's coming to us all the time. And to some extent it is, but it's also because of foreign labor forces that are being paid less than a livable wage and oftentimes in horrid conditions. You know, I mean, our avocados most often come from a village who all of their water is actually being used by the avocado farm. And so the potable water that they drink and bathe with is being shipped into them on a truck weekly, right? So there is a really massive social impact element to this that gets downplayed or not discussed that much. So cannabis, yeah, it's cool. I mean, for the revenue, will we do it? Sure, right? But when you really look at the mission of transforming the food system and creating a more resilient, equitable food system, I don't know, you know?
All right. Not excited by cannabis, which is, yeah. I gather, the norm. These sorts of things. I think we ran out of questions in the group about the actual like nuts and bolts of the thing. It's really interesting. Let's go back to the nonprofit element. There's a famous issue with OpenAI not too long ago where there was this combination between a nonprofit and for-profit, and it, you know, everybody knows that story. Do you want to talk a little bit of kind of how you guys are structuring and how you're trying to avoid some of those governance issues that are plaguing them?
Yeah. I saw the I think it was an All In podcast where they showed like a chart of the corporate structure. It was like, what is even going on here? It made no sense to me. The way we're structured, the fiscal sponsorship is through the Public Health Institute and myself directly, right? So any intellectual property we create can just simply be licensed. We can spin out, you know, our own nonprofit once we're ready, once we don't have to lean on the Public Health Institute as much. But also it's very simple. And like Salesforce and other orgs have done this before. You generate intellectual property as a nonprofit, and then you license that nonprofit to a for-profit. I mean, it's literally just an intellectual property agreement. I don't understand why Sam and the OpenAI team wanted to go with that crazy corporate structure. If there was like if there's some type of control over things they get, or if it was a way of boxing Elon out of the equation, or I truly don't understand why they did things that way, because it doesn't have to be that complex. It really can be as simple as here's intellectual property, here's a licensing agreement to a for-profit, go scale it.
Okay. And then it flows back and have it as a separate company other than the exact same people and moving money around that way. Exactly. That totally makes sense. One thing that I'm just going to let you riff because we have about 2 minutes left. So it's an open-ended question. So is it ethical for philanthropy and tax money to de-risk farming? And
I 100% think so. Right. And like, 501c3s, they're mission-oriented organizations, right? So the beauty of it, if you're working with a nonprofit, the founder or the people you're working with can't really, you know, file bankruptcy and take your investor money and go buy a house with it or et cetera, right? It's a mission-focused organization. You can set up a board of directors to guide the organization and keep it on its mission. And it just opens up so many capital pathways and different partnerships. Like, it's much more difficult to work with universities as a for-profit. It's much more difficult to work with the federal government and work with some of these corporate foundations as a for-profit. So yeah, in my view, it's completely ethical. And in fact, it's highly de-risking for investors to work to do this. I'm hoping we could set a model even for other industries like nuclear fission and others to take advantage of these research budgets. What I found working with nonprofits is if you don't have business-minded people in there, for better or worse, a lot of the money gets squandered, right? But if you have business-minded people in there who think in terms of capital efficiency, you can actually stay true to your mission, execute at a high level, and create that social impact with returns that investors hope to see. So I don't think there's any ethical issue so long as you are aware of the regulations and laws and how they work and just work to, you know, stay in that framework.
Awesome. Makes sense. And actually, there's one more question from Diadub, who was formerly known as C-Dub. Apparently she has rebranded herself. Listeria contamination, staying in the agricultural pipeline. Is your solution make that less of a problem than shipping it across the country? Or is it kind of just, it's going to be an issue no matter what.
Yeah. So with controlled environments, you do have much less risk of pathogens generally in your plants. And the if we truly see this thing all the way through and scale it to the scale we hope to see, then what you'll see is on average a less than 5 mile transportation distance from the farm to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. It's almost very direct. So generally speaking, yeah, pathogens, contaminations across the board, it should be significantly less of a risk.
Gotcha. Awesome. Well, that does, and we can talk about this for a while, but that does take us to the top of the half hour. We're here, some housekeeping items for you before you bump you into tap rooms. Networking, not pitching, be kind. We do not do a full participant list. So if you meet somebody you want to connect with, do it there or join our Telegram group. The details are in the chat already, and I can almost guarantee that they'll be put in there again. So introduce yourself, say hello. Speaking of introducing yourselves, that's typically how the tap rooms start. First 30 seconds or so, just do a quick whip round. Everybody says what they're up to, something interesting. And then if you have time and are so inclined, discuss the topic. And the topic is what Isla told you the topic is.
Yeah. And let me just do one more shuffle here. Right. And the topic here is which country do you think is going to lead in all things new innovative agriculture in the way that Ian described it? I'll pop you into rooms now and we will see you back here. All right. It does feel like we might have lost Kenny at some point in the shuffle because everybody Woo-hoo! Else.
Did what now?
No, we just lost you.
I just disappeared. Poof. No, I messed up and I went in the speaker's room. We used to try to mess it up, mix it up a little bit. But okay. I got some extra Ian grilling time. But now we're back in the main room. And Ian, I completely forgot to warn you because I always ask the same question, which is tell us the future. So feel free to unmute and tell us what you're excited by. May or may not have anything at all to do with sustainable agriculture.
Yeah. In the next 10 years, you're going to be seeing 5-story greenhouses growing hundreds of thousands of dollars of food in a city near you, with that food being delivered less than 5 miles to the grocery store. I don't necessarily see a world where everybody's growing food in their backyard. I hope that everyone here who has the space would take up some gardening, right? It is really helpful. But for better or worse, people, they want to do what they want to do and work their different jobs, et cetera, right? But you absolutely are going to see 5-story greenhouses growing hundreds of thousands of dollars of crops at a time, with a farmer making an actual living for themselves, right? Rather than someone earning less than minimum wage being abused by a massive multinational corporation. So that's what I'm really excited for, is an equitable, resilient food system where people are being paid a living wage to grow healthy, nutritious food right there in your city.
Fascinating. Well, I think the gutting of a lot of urban centers recently post-COVID is probably going to help accelerate that, right? I'm assuming that's a pretty core part of your thesis as well.
Yeah, big time.
All right, makes sense. I'm excited to see my first 5-story greenhouse while I'm driving down the road. Isla, did we fill enough air for you to shuffle breakout rooms there?
Yeah, we've all been shuffled. And this is an opportunity to talk about what are the kinds of farming projects you've seen around your city. I used to live in Singapore, and yes, there was quite a bit of vertical farming experiments happening there, mainly lettuce, I think. Yep. Understanding what was happening there. But please share. What are the kinds of things that you have seen around your neighborhood, city, state that might fit into this urban innovation and farming space?
All right. And that's actually a good segue, David. Thank you very much. Welcome back, everybody. Quick wrap-up items. This is a weekly event. Come next week. 6 days, 23 hours. Talk about money transmission businesses, in particular, how people are trying to disrupt it. Telegram, join it. And then April 30th, we are co-hosting an event with Dean and Kat, who aren't here anymore. But they were here, so some of you met them in the breakout rooms. And that is an in-person event, so come check it out. But that's enough about us. Ian, you want to unmute yourself and plug your pluggables? You already put it in the chat, but feel free to read it for the transcript.
Yeah, 100%. So please, we are fundraising. We've been invited to apply to a number of corporate grants, the American Heart Association Social Impact Fund. There's some really exciting USDA grants that are coming up, but we do need matching funds in the bank to unlock some of those. We're trying to launch our first pilot facility right now and show people what's truly possible. So please hit me up, ian@thecityfarmers.org. And it looks really good as a tax write-off as well, making a donation to the Public Health Institute of Metropolitan Chicago. So yeah, thanks for the time, Kenny. Thank you for inviting me to the space, Ayla, and really good.
You're welcome.
As always, Isla does everything around here. I just show up. All thanks go to her. Thank you, Ian, for sharing some of your wisdom, and everybody else for showing up. doesn't work without you. So have a good week. We'll see you very soon.
Bye now.
Bye. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Bye bye.
See ya.
That's all, folks. Hope you learned something new. If you join us on Zoom every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Central, you can also network with other fascinating alternative investors from all over the world in small groups of four or five. Learn more on our website at www.diffusefunds.com. Until next time.